Hello and welcome to Talk Nerdy. I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria, and I've got a really exciting show for you guys tonight. I say that every week, but I learned a lot on this one. I thought it was pretty cool. Before we get started talking about exoplanets, I want to thank those of you who keep Talk Nerdy going week after week. As you know, Talk Nerdy is both advertising and listener supported. Lately, it's been much more listener supported because I have been so overwhelmed with other work that I have not been able to chase down a lot of advertisers. So I especially want to thank those of you who just, you know, you're so amazing for giving, for being so generous, and for ensuring that Talk Nerdy is free to download for everybody who would like to. So over on Patreon, which you can visit by going to patreon.com/talknerdy, I want to thank Phil T-Bear and Timothy Glover. I also want to thank Ken Pfeiffer, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. Thank you so much for your support. And through the PayPal portal, which you can access at carasantamaria.com, I want to thank Rob Miller and an incredible, just incredible donation I received this week. I don't even know how to describe how generous this support was, but it came to the Talk Nerdy program from Mark Mirsky. So generous, in fact, that I had to email you, Mark, from Minneapolis, Minnesota, and make sure that you didn't accidentally add a zero to this donation. And if you did, no worries. I will refund it back. I totally get it. If it wasn't an accident, oh my God, I don't know how to thank you. This is definitely the biggest listener-supported donation that the show has received in its, I don't know, what is it now, year and a half history. Thank you so much, Mark. This will go towards setting up the new studio when I move into my new house in about 2 months. I'll be able to really get the mics that I need. I'll be able to do some great soundproofing and just do a lot of work that I have been holding off. And because of you, I think I'm going to also need to go to my Patreon page and reset all of my goals and my rewards and change the model a little bit. It's just, I can't thank you enough. So, okay, I'll stop gushing. But thank you so much, Mark. And thank you so much, everybody else who keeps Talk Nerdy going week after week. All right, I'm really excited about this week's episode. I am joined this week by astrophysicist Dr. Leslie Rogers, previously of Caltech, currently of Berkeley, and also interested. Also? No, always. That's the word I was looking for. Always interested in exoplanets. Here she is, Leslie Rogers. Well, Leslie, thank you so much for joining me to talk nerdy today.
Oh, my pleasure.
I'm so excited. It's funny because we've been trying to sync up for quite a while, but both of us have insane schedules.
Yeah. that are completely out of phase.
Exactly. And also USPS was not doing us any favors with the delivery of a nice recording headset. But now, you know, all of that is behind us and we are ready to go. And I'm really thrilled. So you were recommended, we haven't met in person, which is always kind of interesting when I do a chat like this, but you were recommended by Dr. Chiara Mingarelli, who I spoke to earlier on the podcast about gravitational waves, because you are a fellow Caltecher with her. But right now you're not living in Pasadena, are you?
No, I'm not. Actually, I just moved as of September 1st, and I'm currently working at Berkeley.
Nice. And so is this a whole new appointment? Are you no longer at Caltech or is it some sort of dual appointment?
This is a whole new appointment. So I'll be at Berkeley for a year on a Sagan fellowship. And then I'm going to be moving to the University of Chicago next fall to start a professor position there.
Oh, that's so exciting. So, okay. You were at Caltech on a Hubble Fellowship, and now you are at Berkeley on a Sagan Fellowship.
Exactly, yes.
That's kind of the coolest thing I've ever heard.
Yeah, there's quite luminary names to try to live up to.
Seriously. And, of course, just people who have influenced so many young scientists.
Yes. Yeah.
I love it. I think it's great. And so I'm really excited to be able to do some of this science communication with you, to be able to talk about your research, which I know is something that Sagan would be proud of.
I hope so.
And so, you know, Dr. Mingarelli, as we were discussing on air, we talked a lot about gravitational waves and gravitational lensing and how we're trying to understand them and look for them in the cosmos. But you have kind of broad research interests. I was looking at your website and I saw that you have very broad interests in astrophysics, but you specifically do focus on exoplanets. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yeah, And among exoplanets, much of my research focuses on planets that are Neptune size and smaller. So I'm really focusing on kind of the smallest planets that are being discovered to date.
Interesting. And so these are obviously planets that before probably some sort of threshold in time, we couldn't detect because they were too small.
Exactly. So when I first started grad school and first started studying these sub-Neptune size planets, we hadn't yet measured the radius of an exoplanet smaller than Neptune.
Wow.
So it's been really neat to see over the past decade kind of this field just explode from essentially being a theoretical endeavor to now we have all this data in hand that we can start to interpret.
What is that like, being somebody who has expertise in a brand new field, basically in a brand in a data set that didn't exist and now has just tons of information in it?
It's super exciting. Yeah, I had to pinch myself every now and again. Because I'm essentially seeing the field evolve on year timescales, and there's always new planets being discovered. There's kind of constantly planets being discovered that we didn't expect. Kind of all the theories are being challenged. So it's a really exciting time.
So is there like a date? I remember when I was back at HuffPost and I was writing about space a lot more often, I remember finding there's some sort of exoplanet database, right? Where you can go online and you can look at everything that's been kind of cataloged to date.
Yes. Yeah, so there's actually a couple different databases. The NASA Exoplanet Science Institute, NEXI, has its own exoplanet archive where they keep a catalog. Maybe one of the first databases was exoplanets.eu, kind of a European catalog of all the exoplanets discovered to date. And there's also exoplanets.org, which is an effort based out of Penn State University, where they also have their own kind of catalog and database where you can essentially see all the properties of the planets that have been detected to date and make plots and try to look at trends or correlations in the data.
That is very cool. I just went to the exoplanet archive that NASA is keeping, the IPAC.
Yes.
And let's see, 1,892 confirmed planets as of September 18th, 2015, 474 multi-planet systems, 4,696 Kepler candidates, and then there's a whole bunch more statistics for candidates and for confirmed planets. So are you generally looking at planets that have already been confirmed, or are you looking for planets?
So in my research, I typically study planets that have already been confirmed. So in my research, essentially, after a planet hunter has discovered a planet and maybe measured its mass and radius, I then try to figure out what it might be made out of. What could its bulk composition be, and how might that planet have formed?
Cool.
Yeah.
And so when I just click through all of the confirmed planets here on this archive, and you basically get like a big spreadsheet that has all of their names, their letters, their discovery method, the number of planets in their system, their orbital period. This is so cool. Their eccentricity. And there is a column for planet mass. But of course, there are a lot of blanks in
it. Yes. Yeah.
And so do you wait until the research shows that, okay, this is a planet that is very, very small, and then you start looking into understanding it a little bit better? Or do you look at planets that have been discovered and say, I want to help figure out how big they actually are? Like, what kind of research questions are you trying to ask and answer?
Yeah, so one of the main research questions that I'm trying to answer is to understand the composition distribution of planets. So among these exoplanets, these planets orbiting stars other than our sun, we're finding planets that are intermediate in mass and radius from between the Earth and Neptune.
Okay, so generally speaking, they're around, or we find things that are much larger also, right?
Yes,
but you're focused on the ones that are between Earth and Neptune sized?
Right. I mean, those planets in that intermediate regime, I find very fascinating because there's nothing like them in the solar system. So it's a question in terms of up to what size are planets typically rocky? Beyond what size do they have these hydrogen helium gas envelopes like Neptune? Within the solar system, we just don't have anything to directly compare to. But by studying these exoplanets, we can better map out where does that transition between rocky and non-rocky planets occur.
Oh, okay. So let's just to back up to try and get a nice review of our elementary school planetary science. We kind of generally understand the Earth and the Earth's proximity to the sun and the Earth's size, and that we are a rocky planet that also has water and that has an atmosphere.
Right.
And then we kind of, I would say, probably generally understand that Jupiter is like freaking huge and that it's a gas giant, you know, that it's a gaseous planet and it does have an atmosphere, right? Because it has storms.
Right. Yes, it does.
And then it has like moons around it that a lot of people are also interested in trying to, you know, when we talk about exoplanets, we often talk about also the search for life elsewhere in the universe. And we've talked about this quite a bit on the podcast, that we have new ways to look for life now, and there are new candidates. Like, it's no longer just an exoplanet that's in a Goldilocks zone. Maybe there's another way that energy can be be created, or not created, that's the wrong way to put it, but that there's enough energy on that body in order to potentially sustain life.
Right.
So we know, you know, that's why we're really interested in Europa, one of Jupiter's moons, to see if there's a liquid water underneath that icy shell. But so Neptune, how big is Neptune relative to, let's say, the Earth or to Jupiter, which I think are probably good reference points for a lot of people?
Yeah. So Neptune is about 4 times the size of the Earth in terms of radius.
Okay.
And Jupiter is around 11 times the size of the Earth.
See, I always thought Neptune was small.
Oh, well, it is compared to Jupiter and Saturn, but it's still pretty big compared to the Earth.
That's really interesting. I think we're so used to seeing like the little solar system models that are never to scale.
Right.
Like, they never show the inner planets being very close together and the outer planets being like way out there. We always think of things as being kind of evenly spaced.
Right.
And I always remember seeing Neptune as this little blue dot and never really thinking of its relationship to maybe Mercury or Mars or Earth, which I'm assuming are more similar, right? Even though Mercury is much smaller.
Yeah. So
I'm like, okay.
So Mercury is much smaller than the Earth. But yeah, the 4 inner planets in the solar system, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, they're all rocky planets. So their compositions are dominated by kind of silicate rocks and iron.
Mm-hmm.
But then when we look at Neptune, at 4 times the size of the Earth and around 17 times the mass of the Earth, it's about, 5 to 15% hydrogen helium gas by mass. So Jupiter is mostly hydrogen helium for the most part, with some kind of rocky material mixed in. Uranus and Neptune is kind of somewhere in between Jupiter and the Earth, in which they have these gas envelopes that are kind of 5 to 15% of their mass, and then the rest of the planet is some mixture of rock and ice.
Oh, so if you go deep, you go inside of that, what we think of as that blue kind of ephemeral looking,
yeah,
cloudy, mucky gas envelope, as you called it, there actually is more of a rocky body down inside of there.
Right. Well, there's rocky material, but it would be at very high pressures and temperatures. I mean, astronomers often call it a heavy element interior. Because to astronomers, any element that has a higher mean molecular weight than helium, with kind of four atomic mass units, is considered a heavy element. So, so there is some sort of heavy element interior, kind of concentration of rocky or icy material in the center of Uranus and Neptune, but it's at such high pressures and temperatures under the weight of this gas envelope on top that it would be in phases that we wouldn't necessarily recognize from our day-to-day experience here on Earth.
Oh, so it probably wouldn't look like soil or like rock.
Right. It wouldn't look like rock. It wouldn't, and even if there's water, it wouldn't look like liquid water or the ice that we're familiar with in ice cubes. It would be kind of these very high temperature phases, kind of either a plasma or something called a superionic solid. Yeah, so there's a lot of kind of high pressure condensed matter physics that people are studying in the context of planet interiors.
Oh, that's fascinating. So it's definitely not like that layer cake that we're used to seeing in our textbooks. Like you look at Earth and there's, you know, the mantle and you know, you have all the different layers of, and it gets warmer as you go towards the center, towards the core. You definitely don't have that kind of consistent stratification in the core of a Neptune-like planet.
Right. Or actually that's a topic of ongoing research or kind of an ongoing question, just how stratified or not are Uranus and Neptune.
How cool. So we don't even know.
Right. Because I mean, from kind of remote sensings and probes, we can get some idea of the composition of Uranus and Neptune or Jupiter's atmospheres, but that's really just the very outer layer. And then from kind of measuring the planet's mass and its size, and also we can get some additional information. I mean, measuring the planet's mass and size gives us its mean density, which also puts some constraints on the bulk composition of the planet. But there are many ways, if you think that we kind of, in our kind of main ingredients to put a recipe together to build a planet, kind of perhaps the main ingredients are the rocky material, water, and then hydrogen, helium, gas. So those are three different materials with three different densities. Mm-hmm. There are many ways you can combine those three materials together in different proportions to still build a planet that has the same mass and radius.
So we've got different kind of candidate compositions
exactly
that we have to work within.
And
because there's no way to go that far away, land something on the planet, drill down into, I mean, that would be like a massive endeavor. We've seen what we've done recently with the Mars rover, which is huge, but I know it's a big kind of debate right now, even within NASA wanting to build a probe to go to Europa. Like, do we even have the means to be able to land on the damn moon? Do we even have the means to be able to drill down into the ice? Or is it better if we just orbit it for a while and get these great pictures and try and infer from that? I mean, this is like crazy difficult and very expensive space travel we're talking about.
Yes, but I mean, we also have this kind of deep curiosity to know, is there life elsewhere in the solar system or elsewhere in the universe? And the ocean on Europa would be a wonderful candidate. So I don't off the top of my head know the current cost estimates for such a mission, but I think compared to kind of the amount of money that's spent on defense or kind of other budgets, kind of NASA's budget for planetary exploration is pretty small.
It is. I mean, I think at least the last time I checked, it was something like half of 1% of the overall budget for the United States. And you're right. I mean, we spend an exorbitant amount on defense. And if we could even borrow just a little bit against that, we could literally double or triple or quadruple the budget, and it still wouldn't be that much money. But I definitely know, you know, I'm friends with some people that work on the Europa mission over at JPL. And you do hear the arguments all the time between the engineers and the scientists, like, no, we need to do a flyby first. No, we need to work on a lander. Because it is kind of, you get different information from that. And of course, it does seem like when it comes to astronomy and astrophysics, there's a lot of, okay, we've got, it's almost like paleontology in a way. It's almost like forensic science in a way. You have a handful of very strong clues and of very good measurements and helpful pieces of data, but then you have to infer a lot based on sort of different parameters.
Yes, that's exactly true. And try to put some story together that can explain the observable data and hopefully make predictions as well that you could then test.
And so, okay, so we've got kind of a good understanding now of how big and how sort of compositionally confusing Neptune might be. And of course, we have a lot of very good data about Earth. Which is why I think in the early search for exoplanets, we were only looking for Earth-like planets because we only thought that Earth-like planets could potentially support life. But you're looking at this in-between range that, as you said, it doesn't exist. There's nothing larger than the rocky bodies, but smaller than Neptune within our own solar system, is there?
Correct. There's not.
And so this is an interesting candidate parameter that... It exists elsewhere in the cosmos, doesn't it?
Yes. So, in fact, based on the discoveries of the Kepler mission, which looked for planets transiting their host stars, they estimate that roughly 50% of Sun-like stars host a planet that's in this kind of size regime between the Earth and Neptune, on orbital periods interior to 100 days.
Okay, so break that down for me. So about half of the observed planets that were eclipsing their star. Is that a way to put it? Eclipsing?
Maybe yeah, that's not quite eclipsing right. is a fine word.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
About half of them have what descriptions?
So... Based on the planets that Kepler found eclipsing their stars and correcting for completeness, kind of the planets we'd expect to miss just because their orbits aren't nicely aligned so that they pass in front of their star from our point of view, we estimate that essentially half of stars like the Sun have a planet that's intermediate in size between the Earth and Neptune.
Oh, wow.
On the close-in orbits that we're sensitive to with the Kepler survey. So
that means there's a lot for you to be studying.
There is a lot for me to be studying. So even though our solar system doesn't have anything in this intermediate regime between the Earth and Neptune, they appear to be common around other stars like our Sun.
Interesting. So tell me a little bit about Kepler and about what that mission is and or was and what has been discovered on it.
Yeah, so Kepler is the current record-holding mission that has discovered and characterized more planets and planet candidates than any other. And so in its nominal mission, it essentially stared at a patch of the sky towards the Cygnus constellation, monitoring all told around 200,000 stars over a time span of 4 years. And it was essentially just measuring the brightness of each star and looking for apparent dips in the brightness of the star for when a planet would pass in front of it.
I see. Kind of like the transit of Venus.
Exactly like the transit of Venus. But
gave us information about Venus long before we could actually understand it in any other way.
Exactly. The main difference here is, whereas like anyone who got to see the transit of Venus when it happened a couple of years ago, you could actually see kind of Venus crossing the disk of the sun. These Kepler stars are so far away that they're just point sources of light to us. So we don't actually see kind of the disk of the star. Instead, we're just measuring the apparent brightness of a point source. And we just see the, like when a Jupiter crosses in front of a star like our sun, that point source of light will dip by about 1%. So we're just measuring those apparent decreases in the apparent brightness of a star to infer the presence of a planet.
So it's really kind of about numbers. It's about this instrument. Is it a telescope, or is it a more specific instrument that only looks at light?
Well, it is a telescope, and it is only looking at light in pretty much a broad, it's collecting all light across the full visible spectrum.
Okay. And so that's every color that we can see.
Essentially, every color we can see with our eyes is kind of the light that Kepler is collecting.
Yeah, because we forget sometimes, you know, I think that in the sciences, when we talk about a telescope or we talk about an instrument, it can mean so many things.
I think
in the public, oftentimes we think, well, a telescope is something that you look through and you can see things.
Right.
But lots of times it's telescopes detect things that we cannot see with our naked eyes.
Right. So Kepler is studying stars that are, for the most part, far too faint for us to see from the ground with our naked eyes. Which is why it's in space. But also, the other benefit of putting it in space is that Kepler could essentially stare pretty much continuously for 4 years without having to close up when the sun would come up, essentially. So Kepler was on an Earth-trailing orbit. So it's gradually drifting further and further away from the Earth. And it could stare at the same patch of the sky continuously so as to try not to miss any times when the planets would transit their star.
Yeah, that's very cool. And it's probably found a big chunk of the exoplanets that we know about, right?
Yes.
Because that's really what Kepler was all about. So whenever we see a news article, I think a good one, and the reason that Kiara first connected us, would be Kepler 452.
Yes.
Or 452b, which we heard about a lot over the summer. A lot of people were calling it Earth's twin or Earth's cousin, which I know you can probably explain might be a little bit premature.
Right.
But that's a very popular, you know, a lot of these things are named Kepler 97, whatever, you know,
They
just named a number because they were discovered by this Kepler craft.
Exactly.
So let's maybe talk about 452b. Is this something that you studied specifically in your work, or is this something that's so allied to the type of work that you do that you kind of just really needed to understand what was going on?
So I haven't studied that planet specifically, and I wasn't involved in the paper that announced its discovery, but I think some of the research that I've done on other planets helps to inform whether we should really describe Kepler 452b as a rocky planet or not.
Mm-hmm. And so all I remember around this time, and probably what a lot of other people will remember, is just news article after news article after news article of, we found Earth's twin.
Right. So maybe let me summarize a bit about what Kepler 452b is, kind of the properties that we know about this planet.
Sure.
So it's orbiting a star that's pretty similar to the sun, just a little bit more massive and a little bit older. And the planet has an orbital period that's a bit over 380 days.
Okay, so kind of close.
Yeah, so it's pretty close to an Earth-like or year. And so it's receiving about the same amount of irradiation as the Earth is, just a little bit more, But based on kind of some estimates of the range of orbital separations where a planet might be able to host liquid water oceans on its surface, this planet could be in that liquid water zone or the habitable zone of its star. Now, the one catch is the planet has a measured radius of 1.6 Earth radii.
So it's a bit bigger, like one and a half, a little more than one and a half times our size.
Yeah. And there's some uncertainty there, but it is about 60% larger than the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And so based on the work that I've done interpreting the sample of planets, granted with closer in orbital periods, but for which that were discovered by Kepler, but that we've been able to follow up with ground-based telescopes to try to measure their mass, the masses of these planets.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, all the planets for which we've measured their masses that are 1.6 Earth radii or larger, those planets are all so low density that that transit radius that Kepler is measuring can't be defined by a rocky surface.
So it must be, it's not a gas giant, but it's a gas medium-sized.
Yeah, exactly. Some sort of subgiant, or maybe. So based on the sample of planets with closer in orbital periods, for which we have measurements of their mean densities,
mm-hmm.
most 1.6 Earth radius planets have these substantial volatile envelopes that contribute to their radius. So we don't really have any planets out on these one-year orbits for which we have a measured mass, radius, and mean density. So we are extrapolating in any case to try to say anything about this planet that's out in the habitable zone.
So anything that we think of as what we call the habitable zone or the Goldilocks zone, which I'm assuming just has to do with how far away from the sun it is, how large their sun is, something that seems like it could support liquid water.
Exactly.
And so any candidate that we found up until this point that is within a habitable zone is likely not a rocky body like Earth.
Well,
that's a tough question.
Yeah, so it's a tough question because there has also been other planets found in the habitable zones of lower mass stars.
So
Kepler mission, one of its prime objectives was to characterize essentially the occurrence rate of Earth twins, like how mm-hmm. common are Earth-sized planets on Earth year orbits around sun-like stars. And it hasn't quite reached the sensitivity to get down to detecting one Earth radius planets on one-year orbits around stars the same size as the sun. This Kepler 452b is really exciting because they're kind of inching closer and closer, improving the sensitivity step by step. And so this is the smallest, longest period orbiting planet that's been confirmed to date around a star like our sun. But it gets a bit easier to find small planets if the star is also smaller.
I see, because then the dip in the brightness is actually similar.
Right. Well, the dip in the brightness gets bigger. Mm-hmm. But also because smaller stars are less luminous than bigger stars,
mm-hmm.
the habitable zone also moves closer into the star as well. So instead of kind of planets on a one-year orbit being in this liquid water habitable zone, planets on kind of far shorter orbits, like 50 days, 80 days, depending on the star, could also potentially be in the habitable zone of those lower mass stars.
Oh, so statistically that just opens up the number of candidates.
Right. So it means over the four-year Kepler mission, you can see those planets on shorter orbital periods mm-hmm. kind of transit more often so that you can build up the signal-to-noise that way to detect gotcha. Them. And also, planets that are closer to their star are also more likely to be aligned with respect to our line of sight here on Earth
really?
to actually transit the star. So if
okay.
if you envision a planet that's relatively far from its star, you don't have that much wiggle room in terms of how well it needs to be aligned with kind of the pointing to the Kepler spacecraft in order for it to cross its in front of its star from Kepler's point of view.
But so if, I'm kind of envisioning like a plate and it needs to be flat.
It needs to be very flat. Yeah,
yeah.
So
if it's just tilted a little bit, then every time that planet circles its star, it's never going to cross in front of it.
Right. But if you then envision a smaller plate or kind of a planet that's orbiting closer to its star, you could mm-hmm. increase the tilt of that plate a little bit more and the planet would still cross its star.
Oh, wow. So there are a lot of kind of geometric and also physical reasons that if a planet is, if the star is smaller and less bright and the planet is closer, that we could detect it much more readily or more of them.
Right, exactly.
Well, that's interesting. But so Kepler-452b specifically, I mean, the news articles all said, like, we found an Earth twin, but then everybody that I talked to in the field was like, eh, not so fast.
Right.
So what was that? What is that hesitation? What is the difference between kind of the overzealous reporting and the actual science that's being looked at?
So the things that are measured about the planet are just the planet size and its orbital period,
mm-hmm.
and then the properties of the host star. So yeah, so really we don't know anything for sure about the bulk composition of the planet.
I see. So it's not that it might not be an Earth twin. It's that we don't know enough to say whether
right.
it's an Earth twin.
And,
okay.
And not only that, but if we extrapolate from the sample of planets for which we do have constraints on both the mass and radius,
mm-hmm.
most 1.6 Earth radius planets that we've characterized are not rocky.
So if we were just looking at what's probable,
yeah.
we might say it's more likely that this is a gaseous planet and not an Earth twin, but there's still a chance once we get more data that we could be proven wrong.
Right. Yeah.
So why do you think it is? I mean, I'm totally asking for you to speculate now, and you don't have to if you don't want to, but this is something that matters to me a lot, being a science communicator and in some respects working as a science journalist. I do try to make a distinction between the two, and I did that a lot on last week's episode. But why do you think it is that sometimes when there's a new discovery, there's just this unchecked interest in overblowing the headline, in kind of trying to tell that story in a way? Because I can only imagine, right, the general public sees it and they go, wow, that's cool. And then you've got a handful of journalists that are working on it and they're like, oh, I'm really struggling. Should I make this really broad statement? Should I be a little more tentative? But then
yeah.
in the scientific community, I can just see a bunch of people being like,
ooh. Yeah.
Kind of like, oh God, why did they write that? And we've had this, you know, we had it with the Higgs boson, calling it the God particle. And we, you know, just a handful of things. Actually, it happens quite often in science journalism where we have to go, let's stop. Wait a minute.
Right.
Let's read a little deeper into this. And I know sometimes editors write the headlines and the reporters don't even have anything to do with that. But it definitely, this was one of those examples of kind of like the bicep too, where it was like people were ready to say, this is the case.
Right.
Before, and I think this example is even more interesting because with Bicep 2, it looked like it required more analysis. It required more testing to figure out, is this a noise situation or did we actually find the evidence of inflation that we thought we found? But in this situation, it sounds like with Kepler 452b that all the data was there already and it was just being interpreted. So why so quick to say this must be an Earth twin? You're like, I have
yeah. I mean, it gives a catchier headline, I guess.
Yeah. So you really think that's what it is. So it's instead of saying it could be an Earth twin, it's likely not, but there's still a chance it is. It's a little better to say Earth twin discovered.
Yeah. And I mean, when you go back to the actual paper, I mean, I think the paper itself could have provided somewhat stronger caveats on the interpretation, but they do say, oh, there's maybe, they estimated between a 40 to 60% chance that the planet was rocky. So in the paper itself, they are, even though they might emphasize the rocky interpretation a bit more heavily, they are at least upfront that we don't know for sure.
Yeah, which is important. I mean, that's very important. And it's funny, I think if you do a Google search of Kepler-452b and you just look at the headlines, it's cool to see how there's been an evolution with pushback, I think, from more specific experts in the field. So now what you'll see is that the publications on NASA, the publications on space.com and these different places will start to talk about it as Earth's cousin,
right,
or as Earth's bigger, older cousin. And then as you scroll down to maybe less scientifically stringent publications, then that's where you'll see Earth 2 or second Earth, or, you know, so it's pretty funny to see how the evolution in the journalism. Also, the thing that is problematic about that is that there have been studies that show that a headline resonates, a retraction does not.
Right.
So when the first thing you say is often what sticks with people, and even if you take time to piece it together and to come up with a cleaner conversation about it later, by then a lot of people's memories are kind of set because they don't bother to read the deeper dive, which is kind of a bummer. And that's part of what I try to do here on the podcast. And that's why I thought it was really exciting to be able to talk to you, especially about, I know we're a little late to the party, but about one of these headlines that I think a lot of people listening probably shared at the time and probably were reading about at the time.
Yeah. And it's also, in some cases, kind of like the parable of the boy who cried wolf as well. Because, I mean, the field is going to continue to push towards finding smaller planets, finding planets on longer orbital periods, and eventually kind of one that is more plausibly rocky will be found. And then, perhaps this headline may have detracted a bit from the significance of kind of those future discoveries as well.
Sure. And it's kind of sad too, because I mean, every exoplanet that's discovered is special, and every exoplanet that's discovered is absolutely not special.
Right.
And so making that distinction, it really is, it's a conversation about how we define what matters. And so for certain researchers, I'm sure there's a handful, for you, for example, there's a handful of discoveries that are so incredibly salient, that are so incredibly special, that for somebody who doesn't study what you study, go like, yeah, that's just one of the many.
Right.
And then they study something else. They're specifically looking for something else. And they go, yeah, but this one is so special. So telling that story to the public obviously is something that we in the scientific or in the science communication world are always trying to do in a better way. You know, maybe a better headline would have been like, close but no cigar.
Yeah. But again, not quite as catchy, I guess, as Earth 2.0.
So this is an interesting exoplanet to you because it falls within an area that you have a lot of expertise, but you have recently made this transition, you said, from Caltech on your Hubble Fellowship to Berkeley on your Carl Sagan Fellowship.
Right.
Has your research focus shifted with that transition? Are you now looking at more specific things, joining a team that has a slightly different questions that they're trying to answer? Like, where is your research going now?
So I haven't necessarily made a huge course correction. I'm kind of still broadly trying to understand the composition distribution of these planets. But here at Berkeley, I am working a bit more closely with Professor Burkhard Militzer and his group. So they do these intense computer simulations of the behavior of materials at very high pressures and temperatures, like those that are found inside Uranus and Neptune and other planets. And so, so I'm excited to be starting to collaborate with them to try to incorporate the results of their calculations into my models of planets. And one of the big questions I want to try to answer, so it's a big kind of question in terms of, so I mentioned earlier that it's estimated based on Kepler that roughly 50% of stars like the Sun have these sub-Neptune-sized planets on these close-in orbits.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an ongoing debate as to whether those planets formed in situ where they're seen today, or whether they had to form further out in the disk, further out in the protoplanetary disk, and somehow migrate or move into the closer orbital separations where Kepler is seeing them.
So, for example, because I think this is a whole new conversation for a lot of people listening, Earth, for example, was Earth formed kind of where it is now, or did it move to where it is now?
It's thought to have roughly formed where it is now.
Okay. And so the question about, so back me up a little, tell me a little bit more.
Well, so since kind of these sub-Neptune sized planets that are on these very close in orbits, and they're very common, and like I mentioned, most of the planets that are 1.6 or 3 radii and larger, the ones that we have measured their masses and mean densities for, they're so low density that they need some sort of a gas envelope. And so initially that was a big surprise to find such low mass planets so close to their stars that were also so low density that they they needed these gas envelopes. Because in the solar system, there's this nice ordering where we see the rocky planets close to their star. And then there's Jupiter and Saturn, the gas giants that today are located kind of around where the, what's called the ice line in the disk from which they formed would be, kind of that location where water would have condensed to ice. And then further out, you have Uranus and Neptune.
And of course, we tend to make our models based on what we know.
Exactly. And so when Kepler discovered all these close-in, low-mass, low-density planets, they didn't quite fit that story that had been developed for the formation of the solar system. So there's ongoing debate as to whether these planets kind of formed close to their star in situ where they're seen today and managed to accrete a gas envelope there, or whether they had to form out beyond the snow line and then migrate in closer to their star.
Is that something that we could ever actually know? Or are we just blessed with the fact that we can kind of look back in time when we're looking at these stars that are very far away and actually potentially see something like this in action?
So we'd need to look at very young stars to be able to see this in action. And so there is kind of a whole separate field of research that's studying these protoplanetary disks, and they're finding kind of gaps in the disk and all these interesting features that might then be interpreted as the presence of planets.
Okay. Because should we be thinking of these things as there's a very young star, there's all of this gas and material swirling around it, and then it kind of clumps together to form these individual bodies? Is that sort of the evolution of what you called a protoplanetary disk?
Or yes.
A pre-planet disk?
Yeah. So, right. So the planets are forming from a disk that's pretty much just leftover material from when the star formed, from a collapsing fragment of a giant molecular cloud. So overall, that disk has a composition that's pretty similar to that of the star. It's dominated by hydrogen, helium, and then there's also rocky material, water, other ices in it as well.
And then those things kind of collapse in on their own gravity a little bit and start clumping together because they're not quite homogeneously spread out.
Yeah. So as the disk kind of cools, then the rocky material will essentially condense to form solids and build up dust. And somehow the dust can kind of clump together by essentially electrostatic forces. And then there are still parts of this story that we don't fully understand, because somehow larger planetesimals, kind of these 100-kilometer size bodies, are formed. But there's a regime of size where we don't fully understand how the materials kind of clump together.
Oh, because maybe their gravity shouldn't be that strong, or the forces shouldn't quite be strong enough to get it to stick.
Exactly. So for the very little kind of dust grains, kind of electrostatic forces can make them stick together. And then for the more massive planetesimals, then their gravity can get them to stick. But then there's a range of sizes in between where we don't really know what happens there, because neither electrostatics or gravity really work very well.
Could discover a whole new force. Man, this is why astrophysics is so freaking. It's like, it's something like 95% of the universe is probably dark matter and dark energy.
Exactly. Yeah, like there's a lot of unknowns, a lot of mystery out there.
And to think about how specific we can be and how, like, down to, you know, multiple decimal places, we can get very strong data about forces, about sizes, about speeds, about ages. In such a small portion of the known universe, it always blows my mind when I get to talk to brilliant scientists like yourself who are able to use these incredibly strong instruments with incredible resolution to tell these stories about things that are just the most infinitesimally tiny part of the universe as a whole.
Right, yeah.
It's so crazy to take a step back. You know what I mean? Because oftentimes when we start learning about things and we start reading about things, and especially when it's your area of expertise, you're in it.
Right.
You're in the minutia every day. And so taking a step back and being like, geez, the fact that I'm even talking about this is insane.
Right. And now with the telescopes coming online, like ALMA, the kind of a large radio array in the Atacama Desert, they're actually essentially seeing the disks in which planets are forming and being able to just look at a picture that they've developed and think, oh, that's kind of the birthplace of planets.
That's so amazing. This like nursery region.
Yes, exactly.
And my hope is that we are getting better and better, and it does look like it. You know, my field back when I was working in the sciences was in neuroscience, and one thing that I always kind of lamented was that I came from psychology and switched over to biology, and they never talked to each other. Mm-hmm. And I know that that's something that we are getting better at in many fields is being more multidisciplinary. But this is such a perfect example of individuals who study what you study, and then individuals who study these nurseries or these protoplanetary disks,
yes,
as you refer to them, can learn so much from one another, because you're really answering small questions that make up a much larger question.
Right. So in my research studying exoplanets, I'm essentially studying planetary systems that are formed and they've been evolving for several billions of years.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the protoplanetary disk researchers are really studying that initial formation process, and there are clues to be found in both areas that'll hopefully help us better understand the processes by which planets form.
So much to learn.
Yeah.
So much to think about. And gosh, so much to read. Like, I'm sure that half of your job is actually reading publications from other scientists who have written things that can help you understand your research questions better.
Yes. Yeah. Exoplanets is a very fast moving field. So there's, so we have astronomers and other scientists use the archive online as kind of a fully open resource where people post copies of their papers, either that they just submitted or that have been published or are in preparation and they want feedback on. And yeah, there's multiple papers every day that are posted on the archive about planets or some aspect of planet formation. So it's a lot to keep on top of.
And when you talk about the archive, this is, of course, we mentioned it a few weeks ago on the program when I had Casey on to talk about, he was doing some Hyperloop research. The archive is at arxiv.org.
Yes, right? Exactly.
And that's where kind of the newest, freshest, that's such a cool thing in physics. You know, I think you still see some holdovers from older days in biology, especially where there's this, no, you can't talk about this research until it's been published after, you know, a year being in review on this one journal. And it is important. And obviously peer review is incredibly important. But having this, okay, we just figured this out right now. Let's try and have a conversation about it. And we'll talk about once it's been peer reviewed and once it's been really well established. We'll talk about that as it's happening is also a really cool new way to approach sharing answers to research questions.
Yes. And I also personally really like how it's completely publicly available. So anyone can go and read any article that's on the archive. So it...
Totally. There's no paywall there, which is such a pain. You know, that's been a big conversation, especially in the field of journalism science communication. It's like you go to write a paper or you go to write an article and you might have a press release. You might have what other people have written. Unless you work for a university or you have good connections, it's very hard for you to get the source article. Oftentimes you have to reach out to the scientist who published it themselves and ask them to send you a PDF, which is why in the science communication world, we use the hashtag IconHasPDF, which is, it really works. It's amazing. So when you're doing research on something, you put the reference and you can say IconHasPDF, and a lot of other people who work in the sciences are happy to help because they have subscriptions to all these different journals and things.
Right.
It's definitely helpful because goodness, so many things are behind a paywall. And it's like, I know that's a whole other conversation that we could be having about open access, but definitely it's cool to see that there is this archive, and it seems like it focuses specifically on, on physics, on quantitative types of sciences. You see it a lot in computational neuroscience, but less so in more basic neuroscience, for example.
Okay.
So it's cool to see how much the kind of math nerds and physics nerds are sharing all of their information, and computer science too. And so that's really exciting, I think. And for the public at large, you guys, if you're bored one day, dig around in the archive. There's a lot to discover in there. So anyway, this has been such a great chat. We're already like nearing the end of it, which is insane. I know. And so before I finish with my final two questions, which I ask every guest on the podcast, I just want to make sure that, is there anything that you wanted to cover that we haven't gotten to? Anything new and exciting that you're working on or anything that you have your eye on that you wanted to talk about? If not, no worries. But if so, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you.
Oh, I think we had a pretty expansive conversation, actually.
Good. I'm so glad. Okay, great. Well, at the end of every episode of the podcast, I ask my guests the same two questions, and they're big ones, so okay. I apologize for not warning you. And you can answer them in any way that you like, in whatever context you would like to answer, whether it's specific to your field, a personal answer, a more global answer, whatever matters to you. I'm always interested to see everybody's different answers. So the first one is kind of the bummer.
Okay.
And the follow-up is a little bit more warm and fuzzy. So the first one is, when you think about the future, whatever that means to you, mm-hmm. what is the thing that most concerns you or most kind of keeps you up at night? And on the flip side of that, the second question I would ask is, what are you most excited about and hopeful for and looking forward to?
Wow, those are very broad questions.
They're rough, right? They're pretty big picture. But that allows for a great kind of difference in the answers that I get from so many interesting people.
Yeah. So what keeps me up at night?
Yeah, you know, what really worries you?
So one of the things that worries me, I guess, and maybe this will resonate to a certain extent with you as a science communicator, is just the extent to which the media really sculpts our worldview in some ways, and people can go to media sources that essentially agree with their preconceived notions in order to get their insights into the broader world. So, So I guess, I mean, I spend my days worrying about kind of the selection effects and biases that are sculpting our view of exoplanet populations. But then also kind of, I guess, on the more personal level, one of the things that worries me is just what other biases and selection effects are sculpting my view of kind of what's happening out there in the world that I, similar to astronomy, I can't like really go and visit any of these exoplanets that I'm studying, but also in many places of the world, I also can't go and visit and directly experience what's happening in current events. So
sure. So even beyond this sort of echo chamber effect that we see in very divisive politics and in divisive views of the world, we even see a faint version of this bias leaking into every conversation we have about news and current events and politics and the like.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's so true. We often think of the echo chamber and we think of, like, you know, the anti-vaxxers as opposed to the people who are pro-vaccination and blah, blah. But there's so many smaller, more kind of nuanced things that are affected just by the hand of the journalist or by the hand of the person that they chose to interview for that story, for example, and their own personal biases. They really do shape the stories. And who knows if we're getting the complete story. I mean, we're likely not getting the complete story, but if we're even getting a strange kind of shell of what the story actually is.
Right. And then I guess so the more optimistic question, so what am I most excited about for the future? So I mentioned how exoplanets is such a fast-moving field, and it's really exploded in the past few years where we're discovering all these new and exotic new planets. So it's hard to predict what we'll find in the next few years, but there's certainly a number of missions on the horizon that'll be searching, continuing to search for planets, we will eventually find a planet that's more accurately described as Earth 2.0. And so perhaps the prospects of studying its atmosphere and maybe within the next few decades, actually identifying potentially habitable or inhabited planets around other stars. Would be something I'm really looking forward to.
Oh, definitely. I mean, you hear it kind of overused in the media, but you really are working in a field that is on the precipice. Like, there are questions that are being answered every day. There's more information that's being provided and accumulated and analyzed every day because there are huge, huge questions in these fields of astrophysics that just don't have answers. We think of science, you know, I remember reading a book back when I took a philosophy of natural science course way back when I was an undergrad. And we read this book called like The End of Science or something. And it was, of course, our professor wanted us to read it so that we could basically rebut it. But there is this sort of cynical mentality that like there's nothing more to know, that we've kind of figured everything out, which to me is insane. Yeah, you're like, what? People actually think that? It's crazy. And they really do. People think that we've advanced so quickly, and with Moore's Law, we're in such a place with regards to the amount of information that we've accumulated, that there's not a whole lot of mystery left in the universe. And that's such a lie.
Yeah.
It's just not true. And you are one of these researchers that's right on the edge of it.
Yeah. And the more we learn about these planets, the more questions are raised as well. And so, it's a very exciting time, and there's no excuse for being bored.
I love it. So true. All right. Well, Leslie, thank you so much for joining me today. Before we go, why don't you let the people who are listening know? I mean, I don't know if you're on social media or if you have a website where they can learn more, but go ahead and give them any of that information so that they're armed with it as they leave.
Sure. So I do have a website that I granted need to update now that I've recently moved from Caltech to Berkeley. But if you Google my name, you should be able to track down my website. And then I can also be reached at larogers@uchicago.edu.
Very cool. Great. So if you have any very specific questions, she is there. Well, Leslie, thank you so much for joining me this week.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Of course. I'm so excited. And I know that the listeners are just going to love all of the new information they have about exoplanets. And everybody who tuned in this week and who tunes in week after week, I thank you so much for joining me for these wonderful discussions. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.